my pursuers. "Still looking for directions?" he asked, a coy smile playing around the corner of his mouth. "No, sir." I wanted to say so much more, but that was all the breath I had at the time. "Just passing through, are you?"
"Sir?"
"Need a ride?" His smile was growing. I didn't like how many teeth it showed. The drums had stopped. The crowd had stopped. My car started somewhere behind me in the darkness. A flash of confusion passed the policeman's face. I liked that considerably more than the teeth.
"Don't you dare!"
But I was already running. Back down the hill, back towards my car. The pounding of the policeman's feet behind me, but it was so quiet compared to the resounding drums a moment before. The uncertain crowd parted at the policeman's thundering approach, but I was practically flying now. My car never went below 10 miles an hour, but the passenger door was open and I launched myself inside. The slam of the door behind me was the first beat in the resuming drums. All at once, the crowd was screaming again, drowning out the shouts and the threats from the pursuing policemen. Mounting and mounting back into that hellish cacophony, and then just as swiftly dwindling back to nothing, as the engine celebrated its triumph. The old man in my car, or what was left of him, he drove me to safety that night. It's almost morning now, and we still haven't stopped. But just as soon as I work up the courage, I'm going to have a whole lot of questions to ask him. I think I'll start by asking the name of that town. Night 34. Echo of the Dead. There are a lot of people who think death is the end. They think we vanish without a trace, leaving nothing but a rotting corpse that has as much to do with who we were as the moulding shirt we were wearing. Those people have never heard the echo of the dead. The last thought someone ever had before they die that stays rooted to the place, almost like a tree planted in their honour. "It's getting dark." I hear that one a lot. Or, "I wonder if she'll miss me." Or, "Take me home, God." Or things of that nature. I don't know how it works, but ever since my little brother's death when I was young, I've started hearing the echo of all the people who have died in any given location. That's why I'll never set foot in a hospital. My mum tried to take me for a sprained wrist once, but I couldn't get within 100 feet of the place before thousands of whispered echoes started flooding my mind. I couldn't take it. I just bolted and ran the second I got out of the car. Later, a therapist told me that I was suffering PTSD after what happened to my brother, but I never believed it. The echoes are too real, too close, and I hear them wherever I go. You'd be amazed at how many people have died in the most innocuous places. I can hear the whispers in the park, where some geezer must have keeled over from a heart attack or something. Sometimes there are muted screams along the highway or at sharp turns in the road. Even the coffee shop at the end of my street has an echo of, "The ambulance should have been here by now." And then there was Ferryman's Lake. This was years later, when I was a senior in high school. The whole class had agreed to go to this remote lake for ditch day at the end of the year. The atmosphere was electric, music blasting in the cars, beers in the trunk, and that desperate, almost maniacal energy of anticipation tinged with heavy goodbyes. But I could hear the whispers long before we arrived. I didn't want to be the weird kid that day. I just wanted to be normal and celebrate with my friends. I tried my best not to listen. I'd gotten pretty good at tuning it out, but this time was different. These whispers weren't nostalgic musings. They weren't profound or contemplative or sad. There was nothing but absolute mind-numbing terror, and it kept getting louder as we approached the lake. "You feeling okay?" Jessica, the kind of girl who makes smart men do stupid things, asked me as we parked. "Of course, just tired from the drive," I lied. I think she said something else, too, but I couldn't even hear her over the echoed screaming. It was the loudest I've ever heard, even louder than the hospital. This close, I could finally start to distinguish some words, too. Did something touch my leg? What the fuck is that thing? The five other cars had all parked on the graveled shore. Kids were unloading picnic baskets and stereos. I sat in the car, completely frozen by the tumult of madding echoes. I can't breathe. Get out of the water! Get out! Get out! You getting out or what? Jessica again. I had to stare at her lips to understand what she was saying. She met my gaze while she casually stripped her T-shirt to reveal a well-employed bikini top. Then, the flash of a smile I couldn't return. I nodded through the numbness, climbing out of the car to gaze at the calm blue water. Not a ripple disturbed the tranquil mask, not a hint of what could be under there. There was a ferry tied up along the bank, with a cobblestone cottage nearby. A few of the kids were already beginning to investigate. "Don't go!" I couldn't tell whether a whisper or a shout escaped my lips, but Derek, one of the guys hauling beer out of the trunk, was the only one who seemed to hear. "What's the matter? You're not afraid of the water, are you?" He must have said it loud for me to be able to hear it so clearly. Jessica was already ankle-deep in the water, but she glanced back. Her smile wasn't for me anymore. It was tinged with a hint of mockery. Everyone would be laughing if they knew what was really going on in my head.
"What are you idiots doing? Get out! Get out!"
Someone else had saved me from having to say it, though. An old man, more beard than face, was standing in the doorway of the stone house. One of the kids said something, but I couldn't hear it over the incessant, echoed screams. I forced myself to get closer.
"Legend has it that something lives in the water near this shore," the old man replied, loudly.
Everyone was out of the cars now, 26 kids in total, all gathering around the stone cottage.
"Something that has hidden since before mankind first walked the earth," the old man was saying. "Something that strikes once without warning, and once is all it ever needs. Of course, if you prefer, you can fork over $5 each, and I'll sail you to safety on the other side."
"What's to stop the monster swimming over there?" Jessica asked. She was still smiling. I could tell she wasn't buying it. No one was.
"Too shallow for it," the old man grunted. $100 for the lot of you. Special price. Better safe than sorry."
"No way. I want to see the monster," Derek said. He was almost up to his waist now, smacking the still water to send ripples echoing into the deep. Several kids started to follow.
"We should do it," I announced loudly, straining to keep my voice calm.
"Hey, look, I'll pay for it, okay? The ferry will be fun." There were so many eyes on me while I fished out a brand new 100 that I got for a graduation present. So much for being normal, but at least I could live with myself this way. The old man snapped the money out of my hand before I could even extend my arm.
"Smart boy. Smart boy."
He winked, his eye glittering with sly recognition.
"All aboard. Don't be shy. Bags and heavy stuff go in the middle."
I avoided eye contact while boarding. For a terrible second, I looked behind me and saw I was the only one. The people in the water, or those already setting up their stuff on the shore, were obviously reluctant. They looked back and forth at each other, trying to read the invisible will of the group.
"Last one is going to work at fast food for life," Jessica shouted, flinging her backpack into the middle of the ferry.
She gave me a quizzical smirk and mouthed the words, "You owe me." If only she knew how much. Soon, her friends were following her, and a moment later, the whole senior class was converging on the boarding plank. I was hoping the echoes would disperse as we got past the shore. They didn't. Dozens of unique voices soon became hundreds as we approached the center of the lake. Echoes rebounding off echoes, reverberating and growing, flowing and slithering into my head like persistent, intrusive thoughts. Cries for help, screams of pain, or just the animal bellow from the minds utterly devoured by fear. The ferryman
hadn't mentioned the monster again. It was all tourist trivia and blithering about the local plants and animals. He kept looking at me and grinning, though, the discoloured motley of teeth appearing almost feral at times. The farther he went, the more excited he grew, spewing spittle into his beard with every other explosive word or declaration. The continual pounding of sound was making me nauseous. I just closed my eyes and waited for this part to be over. I tried not to think about what might be in the water. There were so many voices that I had trouble keeping them straight, but I made a game out of trying to untangle them. Even so, it took several minutes of concentration before this came to the surface. I should never have trusted the old man. It sounded like a young boy around 12, no older than my brother was when he died. I glanced at the ferryman, who was leaning against the wheel, staring wistfully at us all. No one was paying him any attention anymore, not even when his pale tongue flicked greedily over his lips. The old man flipped something, and the motor gave out. He stretched luxuriously in the sun before making his way to the railing.
"This is a good place to take a dip, if anyone wants to swim," he called out. "Real shallow here, and if you're lucky, you'll see some turtles."
"You sure it's safe?" someone asked.
"I'll prove it."
Flash goes the feral grin. Several people laughed and gasped as the old man clambered up onto the railing, launching himself into a graceful dive and vanishing with barely a ripple. Other people would be jumping in any second, and there was nothing I could do to stop them. I closed my eyes again, sifting through the mounting pressure of echoes.
"Where'd the ferryman go? He's not human. Get back to the boat!"
I opened my eyes again. There was a loud splash and the cheer of laughter which accompanied someone tumbling into the water. I was out of time. I leapt behind the wheel, turning the key and stirring the engine back to life. People were shouting, but I didn't care. It didn't matter who was already in the water. Every instinct was screaming for me to just save as many as I could. The controls were intuitive enough, and I pushed the lever full throttle. We were accelerating quickly, faster than I thought we would. The laughter around me was turning to distress, but I was ready to fight anyone who tried to stop me. No one had time, though. We were moving for less than 10 seconds before something exploded out of the water behind us. By the time I looked back, it was gone. All I could see was a massive, misshapen shadow underneath the surface, twisting and morphing and growing by the second.
"He's not human. Then what the fuck is he?"
There wasn't time to find out. Real screams were starting to mix with the echoes now.
"What are you doing? Jessica and the old dude are still in the water."
Why her, of all people? Was it some kind of cosmic joke that made her jump in first? No, that's just who she was. She was a brave and enthusiastic leader, and it was going to get her killed. I slid the throttle down, and the ferry slowed. I didn't even register going on without her as a choice. There was nothing I could do, though. Her head bobbed under as soon as the black shadow drew near. There was a flash of scaly skin above the water, and then a brief glimpse of Jessica's fingers clawing for the surface. Everyone on the boat was shouting, but soon they were going to be just echoes too. Churning water bubbled red, and I shoved the throttle again. The shadow was moving towards the boat, gliding directly under us. Louder than the echoes, louder than the thrashing water or the shouting kids, there was one more voice which joined the haunting chorus of the lake that day. It said,
"Don't wait for me."
And I didn't. I should have done more, said more, while I still had the chance. But I didn't. And now it's too late, forever. And I'm so, so sorry. I think I'm the only one of us who keeps returning to that lake. I don't go in the water, but if I close my eyes and concentrate, sometimes I can still make out her pale voice peeking shyly from the wall of noise.
"Don't wait for me."
And I know she's right, but I'm still here waiting because, in the end, an echo
is all that will remain. Night 35. The storm is alive. It's hard to type. My fingers are stiff and numb from the cold. My eyes are watering, and I can feel the tears freezing on my skin. I don't know how much longer my power is going to last this time, but I don't think we will survive another blackout. When they find our bodies, maybe not until spring, when this cabin can even be seen over the snow, they'll know it was the storm that killed us. If I didn't write this, though, they'd never know it was a murder. The storm has been brewing for a month before it hit. Rolling grey clouds, teasing us with snow for Christmas. Yet always holding back, despite the continual predictions. The Weather Channel said it was 100% chance of snow every day for a week, before the iron sky finally relinquished its payload. When it did come, it didn't waste any time with slush or dustings either. One night it was bleak and cold and bare, and the next morning I couldn't even see out from my first-story window. My whole college cancelled classes for the day, first snow day I've gotten since grade school. I was planning to just sit around playing video games, but my little sister Clara looked so horrified that I might as well have said I was going to spend the day looking for stray cats to cook. Snow is a miracle. Where was my Christmas spirit? We couldn't waste time indoors. Yada, yada. I don't know exactly how the conversation got away from me, but pretty soon I had the ultimatum of either going sledding with her friends or admitting I was the literal Grinch. Guess I'm spending my day with a bunch of high school girls. Whatever. At least I'll be the cool, mysterious, older guy for a change instead of the blundering freshman. I don't know how many of you have witnessed this, but something very strange happens when a group of high school girls get together. They're all super affectionate with each other, but it's a kind of vicious, competitive affection. Imagine four puppies who are all trying to be as cute and friendly as possible, but they know that only one of them is going to get adopted, and they'll happily tear the others to shreds if it means winning. Don't get the wrong idea. They completely ignored me. I don't even know who they were trying to impress, but it didn't take long before they started daring each other to do ridiculous, potentially life-threatening things. "This time, we're going to steer through those trees," Farris said, flashing all of her sharp little teeth. "Hit one and you're out. First one to make it through wins." "On this hill, I used to do that when I was 4, Clara interjected. Never mind that I happened to know she cried every time she touched snow until she was almost 8. "Let's try it from up on the cliff. Follow me." And then it clicked. The real reason I was here. They took turns riding in the sleds, while I dragged them behind me, the others walking a little back so they could step in my footprints, not have to push through the snow. I wasn't a bitch about it or anything, but I guess I was getting pretty grumpy. By the time we'd reached the top of the hill, I was ready to just dump them all into the nearest snowdrift and head home. I was looking for an excuse the whole way, and when the snow started falling again, I thought I'd found my ticket out. I warned them about how fast it came down last night. They didn't want to be stuck in the blizzard, did they? Of course they did. It was my mistake for making it sound like a challenge. They all sounded like they were having fun, though, and they assured me they would turn back if it got too bad. Good enough for me. I didn't waste any time trudging back alone. The snow was falling in thick white crystals, catching the light like thousands of prisms to scatter it in radiant waves. I've lived in the mountains my whole life, but I've never seen anything like this before. Some snowflakes were as big as my thumb, and I could actually make out the unique and intricate geometrical pattern that each was composed of. I stood there to admire it, while the wind stirred thick flurries to dance through the air in a preternatural frenzy. The footprints we made on the way were almost completely filled in already, and I quickened my pace to beat the oncoming storm. It was getting too dark, too fast. Rainbow reflections were vanishing across the new snow, replaced by dark shadows and a malevolent, ghastly grey, like putrid water. It took less than 10 minutes for it to go from noon to midnight.
Clouds were streaming in from every direction, distorting and writhing together into an impenetrably dense wall. It almost seemed like they were getting closer, too. The ceiling of the world dropping over me in a suffocating wave, like a blanket being pulled tight around my head. I'm not a hero for turning back for the girls. I wish I was. But honestly, they were still a lot closer than the house was, and I was afraid to be out here alone. The wind was picking up, a gentle moan rising into a savage howl that bit through my jacket and stung my skin like incessant wasps. At least it was behind me, so it helped push me in the right direction. But it didn't feel like a lucky coincidence. It felt more like the storm was trying to drag me deeper in. This unsettling sensation was compounded when flurries of snow were stirred into the air like a beckoning finger, appearing so briefly that I couldn't convince myself whether I'd even seen it at all. I wasn't sure I was even going the right way until I heard them calling. Their thin voices were immediately devoured by the screaming wind, so I couldn't be sure what they were saying. But at least I knew where I was going now. The wind altered as soon as I heard them, whistling into a higher pitch to mimic their cries. It felt like there were hundreds of girls in all directions, all crying and shouting, all the voices mingling and morphing into one mighty, omnipresent wail. We slammed into each other, all at once. We were running, and visibility was down to a few feet. It took a moment for us to scramble back up, all of us except Clara, who wasn't there. The other girls just pointed back the way they'd come.
"It was just a dare," one of them said. "We didn't think you'd really do it."
They didn't wait to explain, didn't look back, just ran blindly down the hill in a desperate scramble towards civilization. The pitch of the wind was beginning to change again. No longer imitating the shouting girls, it felt more like an unearthly song that swelled and pummeled me from all sides. The pressure continued to push me from behind, propelling me to stagger the last few feet to the top of the hill. Clara was standing there, her back toward me as she faced the oncoming storm. Her clothes, jacket, shirt, pants, boots, all of it had been removed and piled beside her. Her skin had long since faded from the bright red chill into the blistering black and purple of frostbite. Her naked arms were outstretched as though welcoming the deadly embrace of the storm, and with her head thrown back, I could now tell that she was the one whose song mixed with the tempest's roar. She turned her head to watch me, her blistering skin cracking as it moved, a wicked smile playing across her black lips. Besides that, she made no effort to either help or resist as I struggled to dress her again. She stopped singing to simply stare at me, as though the whole process was infinitely amusing to her. I kept screaming at her to do something, but the only answer I received was that from the unrelenting wind. When Clara was all bundled up again, I put her in one of the abandoned sleds and leapt in with her. I tried to keep her warm as we rode downhill, but then I had to get out to drag the sled on the long trek home. I don't think I would ever have made it if it weren't for the wind again, changing directions without warning to again aid my passage. It wasn't a blessing. The storm had already got what it wanted, and it didn't need us anymore. I kept checking on her every minute to make sure she was still alive, but she seemed to be breathing quite easily despite her deathly pallor. She wasn't singing anymore, but I heard the echo of those unfamiliar words swirl around me as we went. We got home a couple of hours ago. The car won't start, and it's completely snowed in anyway. I've piled all the blankets on her and turned the space heaters on, but she hasn't said a word since she got back. She just sits there and stares at me, half of her mouth curled up in that twisted smirk. Once, I caught her trying to stand and go outside again, but I stopped her, and she hasn't tried since. I managed to get a local news station for a while, but they all seem as mystified as I am. I left it on while I went to brew some hot tea for Clara when I heard her laughing in the other room. I ran back in to see a flash of purple and black skin being carried off in a stretcher. Clara was absolutely howling with laughter. Within seconds, the wind outside was laughing with her. Three girls were found in the snow by paramedics, the news said. They were completely naked, standing with their arms stretched out towards the oncoming storm. I turned off the TV because I couldn't stand the sound of the laughing, but the silence and the staring which replaced it is just as bad. I have this unshakable feeling that Clara is still out there somewhere, or perhaps I really did bring her home, but somehow brought the storm home with her. I just hope that when it clears, it leaves her as well. I don't understand how anyone could go on living with a storm trapped inside of them.
Night 36. Midnight prayers. Years ago, when I was in jail, I used to pray every night. When you're little and you pray, it's because you want something from the world that you don't know how to get. When you're older, it's because the world wants something from you that you don't know how to give. The lights would go out at 11 p.m. and I would pray to be a better man, humiliating myself before the arbitrating silence of my thoughts, begging and pleading and even screaming when the thoughts became too loud to contain. Then, one night, an unscheduled cell search interrupted my routine. The inmates all had to wait against the wall while our block was cleared, and it wasn't until midnight when I was able to begin my prayers. All those years my mother used to drag me to church, she never once told me that God isn't the one who listens to the midnight prayers. I begin, as I always do. I kneel on my bed, close my eyes, and with my hands clasped together, I'll ask, "Is anyone listening?" This was the first night that someone answered, "Yes." I didn't dare open my eyes, terrified that the reality of my cell would be all I saw. The voice was soft, patient, and infinitely sad, as though it had seen and heard more than its heart could bear, but had such respect for the suffering that it stoically refused to turn away. "I'm afraid," I said, because I knew at once that I could not lie to such a voice. "I'm afraid that I'm going to die in here, that the world has decided who I am because of one mistake, and there's nothing I'll ever be able to do to convince them otherwise." "You are right to be afraid," the voice said. "You will die in this cell." My whole body went tense. For a moment, I thought I was talking to a guard who was trying to screw with me. But the calm certainty of the voice was enough for me to keep my eyes closed and believe. If I couldn't have faith here and now, what hope did I ever have? "But that doesn't mean that this is the end. Your body has been branded and discarded," the voice continued. "Do not waste any more time trying to save what is already lost." "My soul, then?" "Your soul is hungry to keep living, and this is how you must feed it. Find and kill a human, and then take your own life. When these eyes close for the last time, the eyes of your victim will open, and you will be the one looking out." The strain to look at my savior was excruciating, but some instinctual terror forbade me. Either I would look upon some unspeakable abomination and be forced to abandon my hope of a new life, or I'd see some impostor and know it to be a lie. "And if I don't like who I've become, I can kill again?" I barely breathed the words. "Will I become a new person each time?" "As many times as you like," purred the presence. "When you're old and tired, taking a child will let dance this mad show again." My mind was racing, immediately disgusted, but enthralled by the idea. "And if I die by chance, if I'm hit by a car or something, and I haven't killed anyone yet, where will I go then?" "That will be up to me to decide." The voice was smiling now. I don't know how I knew, but I knew. I couldn't take it anymore. If this was some sick joke, then I wanted to know before I betrayed anything more. I opened my eyes and flung myself in a rapid dash against my cell door. There was no one on the other side, no one in the corridor which stretched open before me. The voice did not speak to me again. I've prayed to be a good man, and this is how my prayers were answered. I will become a good man, but I had to find and kill him first. Killing another inmate would be pointless. Why start life again in another cell? It had to be a guard, someone with access to the outside, so I could make my way out and then kill again. It took me about a week for me to get a metal shiv that would be up to the job. I took my victim into the yard during the bedlam of a gang squabble. He was innocent of everything, but standing next to me when the opportunity arose. And I do not wish to dwell on the incident with any more detail than that. I only had a few seconds before the other guards tackled me, but it was enough to force the shiv into my own heart. And as the light bled from me and the pain dissolved into oblivion, I prayed again for forgiveness. No answer came but the welcome darkness and the searing white light which roused me in the hospital. I wasn't shackled. There was a woman leaning over my bed, shedding tears of joy that I was all right. Her name was Mariah, and she didn't know that she was a widow now. There was a boy who wouldn't stop wailing and laughing. He didn't know that his father had died on that prison yard, or that I had taken his place. Was it a kindness that kept me from telling them the truth? They were so happy that I was alive that they readily accepted my memory loss, although I did seem to maintain some of his muscle memories and habits. It started off as guilt that made me unwilling to leave them. The guilt alone could not endure through the years as I have done. You probably wouldn't believe me if I told you I loved them as strongly as they loved me. But waking up with my new wife and staying strong for my boy, I've never been so happy as that. I lived with them for 5 years until I suffered a minor heart attack. I felt like a ticking time bomb after that. The big one could happen any day, and this new life I had worked so hard for would be replaced by some unspeakable unknown. Giving up this new life was the hardest thing I ever had to do, but I couldn't take the anxious suspense any longer. It was time to kill again. And again. And again. I wouldn't let myself get tied down like that again. That one was famous, or another had a better house, or a hotter wife. The lives were a blur, fading in and out so quickly that I became everyone and no one. It turns out killing people is actually quite easy. It's not getting caught that's hard, but since I always sacrificed my own life in the same moment, getting caught was never an issue. I wanted to experience everything that life had to offer. One day, I was a schoolgirl. The next, I was a professional athlete or a race car driver. Taking highly skilled people was my favorite, because with a little practice and their muscle memory, I was just as good as they ever were. I spent several years as a number of prominent musicians, leaving a wake of scandals as I inevitably took my own life to move on again. I don't know how many lifetimes I could have spent this way, but I never had the chance to explore them all. I was using a healthy body to experiment with a variety of drugs when I was ambushed by an undercover cop. I didn't have the chance to switch bodies again, and before I knew what was happening, I was back in jail. It was a minor possession charge, and I had plenty of money hidden away for bail, so I didn't make a fuss. The point is that I saw her again at the station. Mariah was dating again. I guess she had a thing for a man in uniform. Seeing her sitting and laughing, knowing that she moved on from me so easily, it just made my blood boil. I guess I hadn't realized until that moment that throughout all the glamorous lives I've lived over the last few years, I hadn't once been as happy as I was when I was with her. It wasn't as easy as I thought it would be to slip back in.
I killed her new boyfriend without trouble, but she didn't stay with me long. It was as though she noticed the change right away, dumping me almost as soon as I stepped foot in her house. I took 2 more bodies, trying to seduce her, only to be turned away each time. Frustrated, I consented to bide my time, waiting until she began dating again so that I could replace him and have her. 3 boyfriends later, the same story each time. I killed each of them, only to be rejected the moment I appeared in their body. It seemed as though she could sense my presence somehow, but each time she turned me away, I only wanted her more. It didn't help that she was becoming unstable. I hadn't counted on how psychologically devastating it must be to continue dating new people, and yet sense that they are all the same. She practically stopped going outside altogether, and I was going crazy trying to figure out how to reach her. You don't know how much it hurts me to tell you what happened next. This is my confession, though, and before God and man and otherwise, I wish my sins be known. There was one person in her life that Mariah would never abandon, and children are always the easiest targets. I caught him leaving school one day. He's been taking the bus since his mum started locking herself in. I was wearing the body of a policeman he'd grown up around, and he had no reason to suspect my intentions when I offered him a ride. I didn't drive him home, though. I was taking him out into the woods, where there wouldn't be a scene. Trying to get close to Mariah through a son might seem strange to you, but after living so many lives, I wasn't encumbered with such artificial distinctions as romantic or maternal love. I wanted to be close to her again. I wanted her to love me, and if she was too broken to love another man, then I was willing to make a compromise on her behalf. "Get out of the car," I ordered the boy, who was once my son.
"Where are we? I thought we were going home."
"Just get out." Those big almond eyes stared at me for a long time. Then he smiled.
"Okay, I trust you," he said.
"We're going to play a game." I got out of the car with him. My hand was cramping up from flexing beside my gun.
"Okay."
"Close your eyes."
"Okay."
"Don't open them. Promise me, okay?"
"Okay, Dad."
He closed his eyes. My blood froze.
"Why did you call me that?" I asked.
"Sorry." His little brow furrowed in deep thought.
"I don't know. It's just that you smell like him, only I don't feel it in my nose."
"Where do you feel it?" The boy crossed his heart, still clenching his eyes shut. I slid my gun back into its holster. "The game goes like this. You count to 100 while I hide. When you open your eyes, you have to find me. Ready?"
"Ready."
When we finished playing, I told him to get back in the car, and we drove back to his home. I didn't go in to see Mariah. I just dropped him off and didn't look back. No matter what happens from this moment on, I know this life is going to be my last. I know it doesn't mean much, but for what it's worth, I'm staying on as a cop. I'm going to protect that boy and his mother for the rest of my life. And when chance or old age takes me at last, I'll deserve whatever happens to me next. I've prayed to be a good man, and this is how my prayers are answered. Night 37. The head transplant was almost successful. We knew the world would not be the same. A few people laughed, a few people cried. Most people were silent. I remembered the line from the Hindu scripture, the Bhagavad Gita. Vishnu is trying to persuade the prince that he should do his duty, and to impress him, takes on his multi-armed form and says, "Now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds." Julius Oppenheimer on the first atomic bomb. That quote comes to mind while watching Sergio Canavero work. When performing surgery, he becomes so mesmerized by the task that myself and his other assistants become indistinguishable from his steel instruments, born and bred for this sole moment when he has need of us. Even the patient isn't a human being anymore, just a puzzle to be deciphered or discarded when the last piece finally breaks. I thought it was the greatest honor in the world when the neurosurgeon accepted my application to join his team. Despite the international controversy over the ethics of head transplants, I knew that I was going to be part of history. I wasn't embarrassed to tell my family what I was doing either. They were proud of the honor I was doing for China. Our president, Xi Jinping, is sanctioning this experimental procedure because he is determined to replace the U.S. as the world leader in science, and it was my privilege to perform on that global stage. Dr. Canavero has explained and rehearsed the procedure with us over the last several months, but this was more rigorous than any of my classes at Peking University. Essentially, we will be simultaneously severing the spinal cords of the donor and recipient with a diamond-edged blade. The donor head will be cooled to a state of deep hypothermia to keep the neurological tissue from dying during the transfer. By the end of the 24-hour operation, we will have reconnected all vertebral bones, nerve endings, veins, trachea, everything. The patient will then be suspended in a drug-induced coma until he is healed enough to move on his own. And then? There's going to be a brand new person with a whole new life to live. Those who are languishing in a paralyzed body will be able to walk. Healthy minds trapped by the ravages of age can be restored to youth. And the very notion of mortality and individuality, and the soul itself, will be forever changed. That's the best-case scenario, of course. There is also the chance that the surgery will fail and will have sacrificed two people to the altar of our arrogance. More than that, though, failure would likely show our best intentions in a macabre light, prejudicing the world against us and our research for decades to come. So many eyes on us, on China, so many judgments and condemnations. The pressure was intense. I could feel it in the air the second I stepped into Dr. Canavera's laboratory each morning. No one smiled, and if they did, it was just a thin, bloodless line that died almost before it began. As we approached the operation date, the other two assistants and I were drilled incessantly on every potential obstacle. 1 second of hesitation during the operation, and we'd be ostracized from all official institutions which sought to distance themselves from our failure. Flashcards, pop tests, rehearsals on dummies, endless study. But we were still some months away from the official operation when I received a phone call at 1 a.m.
"You'll be using the back door tonight."
Dr. Canavera didn't even wait for me to say hello.
"It will be unlocked. Don't bring any identification and tell no one where you will be. Officially speaking, nothing that you do or see tonight will ever have happened."
"What's going on? Is this about..." I managed before being cut off with an impatient hiss.
"Of course it is about the operation. Stop wasting time. We have a long night ahead of us."
The other two assistants were already there when I arrived. I will not use their real names, but instead will call the acclaimed surgeon Dr. Chung, while Dr. Zhao is an elderly woman who leads her research department. Canavero was the center of attention, as always, though, animated as he was, with passionate energy and explosive gesticulations.
"My friends, we are very fortunate indeed,"
Dr. Canavero was saying. He ushered me in from the door, glancing both ways outside, before securing it behind me.
"President Xi Jinping has given us a gracious gift, one that I had long desired but hadn't yet dared to ask. Come, come, not that way."
Dr. Canavero was practically prancing as he turned away from the usual route to our lab. It was almost surreal navigating the abandoned hallways that were typically bustling with life. The naked fluorescent lights burned with a gentle hum like the eternal pondering of an unseen jury. Chung answered my questioning look with raised eyebrows of his own as we all turned to follow.
It's a risk, you know, what he's doing for us. Of course, it will be to the glory of China if we succeed, but with an experimental procedure on the frontier between reality and science fiction, he's gambling with us.
We were in the elevator now. I'd never been to the bottom floor before. You needed a special key to access it. But I'd always been told it was just storage space. Dr. Canavero's feverish excitement while he inserted his key told a different story.
We are already taking every reasonable precaution to prepare,
Dr. Zhao began to reassure him.
But the thing about powerful men is,
Canavero continued, ignoring her,
is that they don't remain in power by gambling. Not without a loaded die, at least.
The elevator door opened to a long hallway with stairs at the end, which continued spiraling downward. The first thing that impressed me was the enormity of the space. It must have been as large as the rest of the facility combined.
We can't trick an operation, Dr. Chung snorted, and even if we could falsify the reports, it won't convince the scientific community for long. It would do nothing but further discredit your...
I'm not talking about rigging the operation, Dr. Canavero said, leading us towards the stairs.
I fully intend to livestream the entire procedure for the whole world to see.
Then I'm afraid I don't follow,
Dr. Chung started, before being cut off again.
Was that the echo of a shout from farther down?
In the sudden silence, we all heard it clearly again. Hoarse, strained, utterly hopeless, as though it had been calling on deaf ears for a long, long time. I rushed to the railing with the other two assistants.
We're not going to rig the operation.
I was the first to speak. The words were difficult to form in my mouth.
We're going to rig the preparation. The whole world will think they're watching something that's being done for the very first time.
It was still a storage space of sorts, but it would be more accurate to call it a jail. The corridor was lined with cages, barely large enough for their human occupant to stand. Below this floor ran another identical corridor with its own set of cages, and even more below that, as far down as I can see. Thin hands grasped uselessly at the wire, rattling them in restless excitement and fear. Others continued to lay on the ground, too broken or hopeless to even turn our way.
While we've already successfully completed it, dozens of times,
Dr. Canavero joined us to look down.
No play would ever be performed without a rehearsal, after all. The moment we accepted the research grants from President Xi Jinping, we have all become actors in his employ.
How many are there?
Dr. Zhao breathed a hot whisper.
Enough to make it a good show, Dr. Canavero replied.
Who are they, though? I asked.
They're not victims, if that's what you're asking, Dr. Canavero said, turning back to the staircase. At some point in all of our lives, we have a choice, to become someone or to become no one. It is their misfortune that they decided the latter, although ultimately it was still their decision to make. I can only hope that my own team...
He stopped here, turning back to level his gaze on us.
That my own team has the foresight to recognize when they are making such a choice, and to do so more wisely.
The implications were clear. Report the incident, and it would be more likely that I ended up in one of those cages than it was for any of them to go free. Science is concerned with the truth, after all, not with how we got there. I took the first step towards the stairs, but a hand caught me by the arm.
Some are likely to survive, though, aren't they?
Dr. Zhao's face was pleading for something that I couldn't give her. I tried to force a smile for her sake.
Of course. That's the whole point, isn't it? We're just learning how to switch the heads.
I knew it wasn't true, even while saying it. Even the survivors would be buried with this secret, I had no doubt. That's when it occurred to me that my fate was likely inevitable for the same reason. Why would the government ever risk these methods getting out? That's why I'm writing this now, though, just in case something does happen. The first operation is about to begin, but I can't help but feel I'm the one about to go under the knife. Is it wrong that part of me is excited too? My family will be so proud when this is over. I'll be a hero. And don't all heroes walk on the bodies of those they couldn't save? Night 38. She can't tell lies if she can't speak. Repeat after me. I must not tell lies. I must not tell lies. I cannot tell lies. Or else. It's as vacuous a statement as you can find. If someone is truthful, then you do not need to make such a promise. If they are not, then their promise means nothing anyway. There's only so much a mother can do when a daughter is a liar, and I was doing the best I could. Marceline is just 8 years old, but she's learning so fast. She can count all the way to 1,000 and has her multiplication tables memorized. She can read on her own without moving her lips, and she knows how to look up words she doesn't know. She loves playing soccer, riding bikes, and roller skating. But her most impressive skill, by far, is her mastery over lying. And she does it every chance she gets. My daughter's favorite lie is about a character named Zaffi she read about in one of her books. If she doesn't want to get up in the morning, it's because Zaffi kept her awake all night. She never breaks anything, but Zaffi is a whirling dervish when I'm not around. I thought it was cute at first, but I knew I had to put a stop to it before it became an incurable habit. I started by punishing her. I would scold her and tell her to stand in the corner, or take away her toys and books when she wouldn't stop. The little rebel fought back, digging in her heels and hotly declaring that Zaffi wouldn't tolerate being stolen from. Marceline was a banshee with an attitude problem, and I'd usually only last a few hours before giving in, just to shut her up. My husband, Mark, thought I was just enabling her, but I couldn't help it. Watching her scream and wail and throw herself around the room like a crash test dummy in an explosives yard was too much for me to bear. "We can't let this go on," Mark said to me the other night after Marceline had gone to bed. "She's holding the whole house hostage." "Fine with me. You get the rope and I'll get the gag. They make those in children's size, right?" "I'm serious," he said. "She might not understand now, but it's for her own good. How do you think she's going to navigate through life, or hold a job, or maintain a relationship when she thinks lying is a magic answer to everything?" Of course, he was right. We had to parent the shit out of that little beastie. She's on a winter break now, and our house was about to turn into liar's rehab. That night, Mark and I collected all her books and padlocked them in a cabinet. He took the key with him to work so I wouldn't be able to give in to her tantrums. Over breakfast, we sat down with her to clearly lay out the rules. "Do you know why Mummy and Daddy took your books away?" I started. I guess she hadn't noticed until I said it. Her little eyes narrowed, the dead rot of winter piercing through the slits. I looked helplessly to Mark for support.
"You've been telling a lot of lies lately, and you're getting punished," Mark supplied. "If you want them back, you've got to do a whole day without lying."
Marceline took a deep breath and pouted her bottom lip. It was almost enough to make me give in immediately, but Mark was there to the rescue.
"Repeat after me. I must not tell lies."
Marceline looked pleadingly at me. I crossed my arms and pressed my lips into a hard, uncompromising line. At last, she rolled her eyes in defeat.
"I must not tell lies," she sighed dramatically.
"And you're going to start by telling us that Zaffi isn't real," I interjected.
Mark grinned and gave me a nod of approval. Marceline wasn't giving us the death glare anymore. Her wide, quivering eyes were much harder to endure. She was even starting to look pale.
"Damn, she's good."
"Say it. I'm going to lock up your skates too," Mark growled.
"I can't," she whispered. "Zaffi hates lies even more than you do, and I know he's listening.
"Marceline, say it," I almost shouted. Mark raised his eyebrows.
"Or else."
She looked wildly around, like harried prey. Tears were welling in her eyes. Mark grabbed my hand exactly when I needed him to.
"She needs this. Stay strong," his grip seemed to say.
"Marceline?"
Mark bellowed.
"Okay, Zaffi isn't real. I'm so sorry, Zaffi. Please don't hurt me."
I sighed. Mark snorted in amusement.
"Good enough for today, I guess.
I'll be home around 6. Think you can hold the fort until then?"
"Bring it on. I can do it."
I gave him my most convincing fist pump. It felt like the first victory we've had over our daughter in months. I had no idea how wrong I was. It started with the silent treatment, although I have to admit that was actually a relief. I expected her to be screaming bloody murder the second Mark closed the door. But Marceline just sat in the living room and glared at me from under her little furrowed brow.
"Fine, let her sulk. At least I could keep an eye on her here."
I sat on the couch with my laptop to bust out some last-minute Christmas shopping. Marceline was muttering under her breath, but I did my best just to ignore her. It sounded like she was apologizing over and over, but it would take more than that to break my resolve. The first time I glanced up, she was still sulking, her bottom lip pushed out as far as it would go. 10 minutes later, and she still hadn't moved. She was just staring at me and chewing on her lip. She was waiting for me to cave in like I always did, but this time I wouldn't give her the satisfaction. I made a real mental effort to not even look at her for the next half hour. But I did look up eventually, and I started screaming the moment I did. The lower half of her face was covered in blood, dribbling down her chin onto the floor like a vampire over a fresh kill. She was still glaring at me, relentlessly and purposefully chewing. At first, I couldn't figure out what had happened, but when I rushed over to her, she spat a fleshy lump in my face. I grabbed it without thinking, mind numb from disgust, staring at the bloody slug-like thing in my hand. She spat another one. It was her other lip that she had chewed straight off.
"I must not tell lies,"
she hissed, spluttering blood as she did. She wasn't grinning, but it looked like she was. Even with her mouth closed, I could see all her ferocious little teeth jutting out of her gory gums.
"What cannot speak, cannot tell lies."
And then she was chewing again, the open wound of her face doing nothing to conceal the gnashing teeth which sank into her tongue over and over again. I had to grip the top of her head and her chin to hold her mouth shut, but it took both hands and I couldn't reach the phone. Tears mingled with her blood, gushing down her face, but nothing could stop the gnashing. Even with both of my hands and my whole body weight pressing down on her head, I could feel her jaws relentlessly lifting me and clamping back down again. I tried to stuff my fingers into her mouth to hold it open instead, but they snapped down so ferociously that I almost lost a digit. It was like trying to stop a garbage disposal with my bare hands. Next, I tried to get her to lie down and relax, but she started choking, and I had to lift her immediately. I thought she was just choking on the blood, but no. A second later, her entire tongue oozed out of her mouth like some giant eel swimming through red waters. At least she had nothing to chew anymore. I broke away long enough to call an ambulance, but even that was a mistake. Her jaw was already working through the insides of her cheeks. She started choking on the pieces again, unable to get them out of her mouth without the aid of her tongue. I couldn't stop her. All I could do was hold on to her hands and knees to let the bloody chunks dribble out of her mouth so they wouldn't go down her throat. She didn't stop until the paramedics arrived and injected her with something that knocked her out. I was so overwhelmed that I couldn't even follow. I just sat on the bloody floor and cried, finally noticing the words which must have stained the carpet while she was kneeling. "Zaffi is real. I must not tell lies." When she recovers, if she recovers, I'm going to have a lot of questions that she won't be able to answer. I've heard there are people here who know about this sort of thing, though, so I'm begging you for help.
What is Sapphire? What do I do now? I know it must be hard to believe, but please don't dismiss it or give me any false hope. Sapphire hates liars, and I just know he's still listening.
Night 39. Under the frozen